We're going to say to everyone here today that we're really, really fortunate to have Dr. Lang. She is the founder of the Beacon Day School for students on the autism spectrum disorder. And she's been involved with the care of children for more than 20 years in educational psychology. And she's been practicing since 1991. And she's a member of several professional organizations, some of which include the National Care Assistant Clinical Professor of the Department of Pediatrics here in Throughout her career, she's worked with children diagnosed with the autism spectrum disorder and has lectured very extensively on the subject. She has long supported children on this disorder here in Orange County. And I want to tell everyone that we're really in for a treat. I want to say, Dr. Lang, welcome to the call on therapies today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be on the call. But my greatest claim to fame is that I have a daughter with developmental disabilities, and she's now, I think she's 27. So
wow.
That dates me, I guess.
Yeah, yes, well. You know,
but she's doing very well, so she's my greatest success.
Very good, very good. You know, could you tell us a little bit about a little bit about the struggles that you went through, and this will kind of give other parents an idea of kind of what you went through, and maybe they can empathize kind of with how you were successful at all this.
Well, 26 years ago, special education really hadn't evolved to the point where it is today, and I fortunately or unfortunately had my own ideas about what was best practices, and even then, school districts were less, they didn't want to spend the dollars for what I thought were best practices. So unfortunately, I ended up paying for everything that I could pay for by myself, because I just made the, it was either pay for it or pay for a lawyer, and I just chose to pay for it because lawyers were and still are exceedingly expensive. So I don't know that there is an easy way to sometimes get districts to do the right thing, especially in economic times where, at least in California, the education budget is being cut rather drastically.
Sure.
So in terms of therapies and things that I did, it was really on-the-job training, much as like it is for parents for children with autism. My daughter Jessica, although not diagnosed with autism 26 years ago, would certainly warrant the diagnosis now. But at 26, it's not a high priority for me to run out and have her get that diagnosis, because she's doing well, and I think you have to define success for each child and each individual based on that individual. For example, Jessica's, when she was ultimately assessed by the school district, came in and said, well, her IQ is 45 and there isn't, we're not going to do much. And that was sort of the tune. But the issue isn't just intellectual capacity, particularly as it relates to IQ, because an IQ score is totally a meaningless score. It just is a summary score, and you can have 1 and 99 get 100, and you can have 50 and 50 can get 100. And so it's really doesn't tell you much about how the child learns and what supports they need. So that's something that is really important. But school districts tend to hold on to that because one of the ways that they determine special education needs is through a discrepancy model, where you have to be 2.5 years delayed or 1.5 standard deviations below the mean. And that's how they determine it. I know that school psychology associations are trying, and some states are trying to get away from that model,
mm-hmm.
but it's still used in a significant portion of the country. And I think this will lead me into what I consider Beacon Day School model and something that I developed, and a little bit about the philosophy that I hope to put into place. And I want to preface my remarks with saying that autism and the concept of autism is changing. And if you have a chance to have any hear Martha Herbert. Martha Herbert is a neurologist, a pediatric neurologist at Harvard in Boston, and she is really looking and developing a new model rather than just being a DSM-4, a Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, a disorder that has 3 core deficits. Dr. Herbert is looking at it, looking at the total child, not only the core deficits, but other physiological issues such as seizure disorders, immune deficiencies, allergies, and how that totality impacts the child's functioning in everyday life.
Yeah.
So as part of looking at the total child picture, when a child comes to Beacon Day School, we look at the following information that is required in terms of determining the level of support, particularly in the first 30 days. Now, just because we may determine, this is a little caveat, but just because we may determine a child needs X doesn't mean that the IEP team necessarily agrees with us, because they may not. But the elements of this model include understanding cognition, which is more than just an IQ. It's understanding attention, how the child attends, whether they're hyper-focused or whether they have a very short attention span, language, visual-spatial functioning, memory, abstract reasoning, or planning, learning, emotional functioning, and how that interacts with the child's ability to use his cognitive strengths.
Mm-hmm.
We look at adaptive behavior, because adaptive behavior is really critical in terms of how a child can function, and I will share with you a little vignette about my daughter Jessica. She was with a group of people at Carnegie Hall at a school she was attending, and they went to they were having a fundraiser there. And after, you know, as usual, after you get out of a concert, it was very crowded, and she got separated from her group. And, of course, they all panicked and called the police, but certainly, but not Jessica. Jessica knew that she had to get to a big hotel where this reception was going to be. So there's the La Meridienne Hotel, which is just down the street from Carnegie Hall. But she missed it, and she kept walking and crossed in New York alone, crossed the streets, and ended up in the Four Seasons Hotel. Ultimately, she was
found. Well, I like her style.
Yeah, that's what I said. I said, at least she has really good taste.
Yes.
And the police found her, and she was very calm. She was sitting in a chair, and the police asked her her name, and she told them her name. And then and her next question is, well, where's the party? So she had developed sufficient adaptive behavior to negotiate a very complicated city, walk across the street, and find herself in a place that was well-lit and safe, and she ultimately waited until she was found. So, you know, that's pretty good adaptive behavior as far as I'm concerned. But adaptive behavior is a lot of things. It's being able to communicate your needs. It's fine and gross motor skills. It's social skills. It is language skills. So really understanding all of those things is very important. Then, of course, social skills is important. Medical issues. Not only what the medical issue is in terms of a child's medical diagnosis, such as seizure disorder or allergies, but also what are the intervention strategies that might be used, including things like medication. For example, if you have a child with respiratory allergies and you give them some respiratory allergy medication, it might make them, as a side effect, very hyper and look like they're hyperactive and have short attention span when it is actually the side effect of the medication. And that's particularly true with medications that have aminophylline in the medication. So you want to make sure that there's, you know, you have good communication with those individuals that are providing educational care and other support services to see if there are any direct medical issues or indirect problems such as medication or side effects from therapy. And then you always want to look at the context, because I know from myself and I know at Beacon Day School, a child may be great at school, but at home not be functioning so well.
Right.
And the difference really relates in terms of the structure that can be provided. And obviously at home, you're not going to be so much on a schedule. You know, you may eat dinner at 6 o'clock, but a lot of things happen. You have to go to the grocery store. You have other activities that you need to accomplish throughout the day or in the evening. And so there tends to be, and naturally so, less structure. Well, children with autism and other and related developmental disabilities don't always do so well.
Right.
So you look at all these things together and you determine the level of support that's needed, and then you put them in place, and it's a dynamic process. So if something isn't working, you want to modify it as soon as you find that it isn't working, and vice versa, if something is working, you want to use that strategy, you know, and might generalize that strategy more. Am I explaining myself, do you think?
Oh, yes, you are. As a matter of fact, as you've been talking, a couple of questions came in, and one of them was they wanted you to elaborate on the new types of treatments that are available for autism, or kind of what do you know that's sort of up and coming, or maybe you can discuss that a little bit.
Well, there are basically some of the traditional models that work, you know, the OT, PT, speech. And by speech, I do not mean just articulation therapy. I mean a higher order language like pragmatic syntax,
Could you explain that? Because I think a lot of people here might not be familiar with sort of the more the terminology.
You want the issue for a child with a disability such as autism is you want them to be able to talk and pronounce the words. But then you want them to be able to use those words to communicate. So there are certain social conventions, like taking turns when you are in a conversation, that are very important. And some children don't think in words. If you remember, any of you have read Temple Grandin's book, she thinks in pictures, so her language is related to visualization, not words, and we're used to thinking in words.
Right.
So sometimes it's more challenging for a child with autism to think in words or to adapt to thinking in words. So we have to be thoughtful about what we are expecting the children to do. Other therapies, there at Beacon Day School, we have music therapy, we have art, we have yoga therapy. So we do a lot of those things. And let me just address, for example, yoga.
Okay.
And the reason we have yoga is because yoga is a very calming experience for a lot of the kids. They learn to relax. They learn to it's not a cognitive task demand. And a lot of these kids, because of the task demands that are placed on them, they become very anxious. And so you want to give them strategies, and when they ask for a break in school or at home, give them a strategy to reduce the anxiety. So yoga therapy, and there are credentials for children or pediatric yoga. I think there's one of the associations, and I don't remember which one, has training programs for children and the use of yoga. So that's one aspect. Other things that are very useful, for example, are art. And
yes.
And it doesn't matter what kind of art the child engages in. If, for example, the child is very sensitive to touching paints and those kinds of things, there are other mediums in which a child can use in order to accomplish what they would like to do. And art is one of those mediums where a child can not only express themselves emotionally, but can also learn and implement and generalize their academic skills, because if you ask the child to fold the paper in half or quarters or pick certain colors, you can use it to reinforce all those activities. And then, of course, there's music therapy, and music is also one of those mediums where children can pick and participate with a group, and it enhances social. All of these therapies can work on social skills, language, communication, and teaches or gives the child the opportunity to learn and to feel comfortable and generalize to things that they might not necessarily have an opportunity to experience.
Right.
There is other therapies include, of course, applied behavioral analysis, and that's a whole broad topic that, you know, I'm happy to answer as specifically as I can, but in terms of managing behaviors, and that's been well-researched and well-documented. Sensory integration therapy is very good. Generally, that's an occupational therapist that works in that realm, although I don't know if that is exclusive to that discipline. And what I have found is that other therapies are developed, but sometimes they're offshoots of these core, they build upon these aspects of physical therapy or occupational therapy or, you know, music or, you know, so they're not a specific, it's not like it's a new discipline. And and this can be very regional, because I know people develop businesses around this, and I'm not saying that they're bad, it's just you have to look at the qualification of the person and who is delivering the service and making sure that it has a good theoretical base and is evidence-based, so you know what you're paying for and what you're going to get in terms of what that therapeutic modality is.
Okay.
Did I answer the...
Oh, yes, you did. I think people here got an idea of sort of the therapies available, which would be yoga, music, and art, and certainly the ABA. And those are definitely great therapies people can read up on further. I did get a question from someone here, actually from the Virgin Islands. That's the farthest person away so far. They have a question, that is, they wanted to know where your school was located and what are the age range of the children there.
The school is located in Orange, California, and we can have children, students from age 5 to 22.
Okay.
We have a transition program that actually begins at 18. And I think that's a federal law where we have to where there's a transition from high school into into adult life, where we give job opportunities and things like that. But that's a very specific program in California.
Okay. I've got a really interesting question here. I don't know if you can answer it, but I figured I've heard this before. Jenny from Elk Grove, California asks, any strategies on how to get insurance or school to pay for alternative therapies?
Ooh. if I knew the answer to that one, I would be independently wealthy and I wouldn't have to work ever again. I have no idea.
Yes.
I know the movement is evidence-based therapeutic intervention. And the issue is that you have to, if you're going to get, for example, a school district to pay for something, then you're going to have to provide them, because they're not going to do the work for you, but you're going to have to provide them the evidence that it is a therapeutic intervention that works. That's sort of their bottom line. And education will not fund things that they think are medically based. And if you ask an insurance company, they aren't going to fund things that they perceive or can perceive are educationally based.
Okay.
So, and somewhere in the middle there is this line, and I don't know where it is.
Yes, but, you know, that's I guess it too depends on the state, wouldn't you say? I mean, some states I know are a little bit more, you know, progressive in this area, and then some others who are not.
I I certainly agree. I can only speak to California, but a lot depends on the state. A lot depends on even the school district.
Mm-hmm.
Because just from having Beacon Day School, I can tell you that there are districts that are more user-friendly and easier to work with than other districts.
Okay.
So I think that's true of insurance companies as well.
Right. Well, I've got another question here from Holly from Clinton. I'm not sure what state that's in, but her question was, what is integration therapy?
It's a model that's been around for really a long time. And the issue that happens with children with disabilities, and particularly autism, what will happen is the district will say, okay, Susie, for example, will get speech therapy 2 half-hours a week. And so Susie leaves the classroom, goes to speech therapy for a half an hour, and comes back. And nobody knows really what the speech therapist is working on. The speech therapist certainly will be working on the defined goals, but the issue is that speech is not a half an hour twice a week. It
right.
is all day, every day. So
mm-hmm.
the teachers at Beacon Day School and the instructional assistants and behavior therapists are encouraged to go to speech therapy with the students so they can observe and help the child to have opportunities to integrate whatever is going on in speech therapy in the classroom, and then, you know, even translate it and provide the parents information at home so that it is an ongoing dynamic process rather than static and just twice a week for a half an hour. And certainly
sure.
that goes for sensory integration issues, physical therapy, occupational therapy, so that you educate the child and you keep the whole child in perspective as the child moves through his educational day.
Okay. I am glad you mentioned this because there's a kind of a follow-up question from someone else here. Her name is Linda from Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and she had a question which was, are the district speech sessions as effective as private, or is it recommended to continue with private once your child starts school? I guess she wants to find out whether to use the speech sessions at school, the public school, or take them to private sessions.
Well, you have to ask what the credential of the school and the private therapist is. And
okay.
And then if you are using both, and some people do augment the school district's therapy with the therapy, you know, the private therapy, you want to make sure that they're not using conflicting approaches, that we're all on the same page, so the child doesn't get confused.
Right.
And the more the merrier, but again, you just want to make sure that it's being used, whatever is being used, whatever therapeutic modality, the speech or goal and objective the speech therapist is working on in school, you want to make sure that the treatment choice is the same and you're working on the same things and everybody understands everybody, because if we are confused, just imagine what the child is feeling.
Sure, sure. I have another question here from Lynn from Boston, And this kind of dovetails onto the question of integration therapy as to what it is. She asks, what's the difference between integration therapy and inclusion within the classroom?
Well, inclusion within, let me explain. Inclusion is just including a child with a disability such as autism into a general ed classroom. That doesn't mean they learn there. That just means they have a seat there. And
okay.
And what happens in that and that's not to say it's bad. I think one of the things that's important is that not all children with autism and developmental disabilities are the same. So what may an inclusion situation may be terrific for one child, but may not be terrific for another child. So each child has to be viewed on his or her own merits and what works for him or her at the
right.
time. But when you're dealing with children who are more moderate to severely impacted, they can't keep up. And I have seen some unfortunate outcomes because everybody wants them to keep up, and everybody is moving, or the concept is that we want to get this child mainstreamed, at least restrictive, but when the child can't manage that, what happens is they start to cry, and then they're taken out of the classroom, and then the next time reading comes up, they cry and pound their fist, and they're taken out of the classroom. Well, inadvertently, what's happening, if you think about it in terms of behavior, is you're reinforcing the crying and the tantruming behavior, when
mm-hmm.
really you have to look at the antecedent management of what's going on in the classroom. Is it appropriate, and or what modifications need to take place to make it appropriate?
Okay, well, I think that answers Lynn's question. I've got a question here. Maybe you can answer this. I'm not sure, but it's from Deborah in Detroit. And she asks, what's the best therapy for a nonverbal child who's 12 years old, who was once verbal, and to get them to be verbal again? I guess that's going to be depending on the, you know, having an evaluation with someone.
Well, yes. If you have a nonverbal child, and I have several children at Beacon Day School that are nonverbal, the issue is really looking at getting a really good speech therapy evaluation and looking at things like interests of the child. And I'll give you some example. I have a child that I've worked with in the past and I've known for years who is a very bright child, but totally nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
So he is very fluent with a Dynavox, which is an assistive technology device like a computer, and it has speech output. And I have another child who is a young lady who is nonverbal, and she's very fluent in sign and uses another assistive technology device. So there are, you have to have somebody, a really good speech and language evaluation along with a good assistive technology evaluation in order to determine the most effective modality in order to encourage speech and language. And it can range from anything from low-tech, like text, the picture exchange system, to very high-tech, which is like a computer, which is the Dynavox that needs to be programmed. And I think that's the best answer that I can give.
Okay. These therapy questions just keep coming in here. I have one person that asked about gymnastics and karate as being therapy. Have you heard of this?
I haven't heard. A lot of the kids will take, you know, karate or martial arts types of things because it allows them a socialization opportunity and gets them into peer activities. What was the other? It was karate and what?
Karate and gymnastics.
And gymnastics. I think gymnastics, you know, again, I don't have a sense that one would necessarily be better than the other. The issue is, why is the child participating? If the purpose of the activity is socialization and opportunity to interact with their peers, you want to, that's great, but you don't want to, you want to look at it in the context of the child. There isn't a blanket response that I can give that would make sense for everybody.
Okay. I have, let's see here, another question here from Nadini. She has a 5-year-old child who has been assessed with autism, and he currently has a stammering problem. He can't express his pain as well, and she's asking if there's any therapy that can help this particular problem.
Stammering like a stutter?
That's what it sounds like, yes.
A stutter? Well, that is, a stuttering is a speech and language communication specialist type of problem. So I really can't answer that.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah, I just don't know how to answer that.
Okay. I have another question here from Marilyn from from Federal Way, Washington. Just in case school doesn't work out, do you have any information for homeschooling? Because a lot of parents may be homeschooling their children. Obviously, they want to know sort of what therapies can benefit them as well.
If you're going to homeschool your child, and it's not an area that I know a lot about, but there are state and local guidelines about curriculum standards. And you need to work with your district or somebody in your education community to make sure that the child is working within the content standards that they are supposed to be achieving, or there is an alternative curriculum. And there is one here in California called Basics 2. That is,
say that again.
Basics 2. It's BASICS 2. It's the second edition of it. It was developed by San Bernardino City Unified School District and a neuropsychologist. And it is very developmentally based. It has an assessment tool. We use it at Beacon, and there are other assessment tools, I'm sure, available. And there was another one that was developed and put out by the Orange County Department of Education here in Orange County, California. And I can't remember the name of that one. But if your child has a moderate to severe problem with autism, then you know, those curriculum might be appropriate. Otherwise, there are, you know, you're going to be faced with the content standards for general ed curriculum, and you have to provide, there needs to be books and curriculum materials and all those kinds of things. And there are organizations out there, and I can't think of the name of one right now, that do, that will guide you in this process. But I'm not an expert in homeschooling, so that's probably all I can tell you.
Okay. Hey, I've got one, I think, right down your alley here. It's Debbie from Spring Hill, Florida, rather. How do you teach your child through social stories? Do you work on one story at a time until it's mastered, or can you attempt to teach several stories? How do you schedule the social story within the day-to-day activities? I guess that's three questions there.
Okay, well, you can use, to my knowledge, you can use multiple social stories. It doesn't have to be one at a time, but you might have one on, you know, it depends on the child, but it might be toileting or transitioning or, you know, and you can use them at the appropriate times. And there are several people that are authors that are very good at that, and I'm unfortunately I can't recall their names, but I'm sure if you Googled autism social stories, you would be able to get some more specific answers to that question.
Okay. As a matter of fact, could you sort of describe, for, in case someone's out there and doesn't understand what sort of social stories are, could you kind of describe kind of what that's like?
Well, a social story is putting into context or priming the child so when they get into a social situation, they know what to do. For example, you're going out to your over to your neighbor's house, and you want a child to say, "Hi, how are you?" You might pull out the social story before you go and say, "Here's a story of Johnny, and he's going next door to visit his friend Jimmy," and you have a picture, and you can either use real life pictures, or you can use, you know, pictures from the computer, and you write a text based on what the situation is. You know, the Jones family is going next door to meet the Smith family. And there's a picture of the two different houses. What do you do when you walk over to the Smith house? You ring the doorbell. Then what do? You open the, they open the door and you say hi. And it's the kind of thing where you sequence out what we take for granted in terms of social skills. Children with autism need to be primed and taught how to, what are some of the social nuances and conventions in our society. We don't run next door and just burst in the door and say, "Hey, I'm here for dinner," you know.
Right.
Because that sometimes will get you into trouble.
Right. Well, let's see here. Great answer. And, man, we're just getting some great questions are coming here. This I like this one. There's a woman named Yetta from Washington, D.C., and she says, this, a group of parents and I have started a parent-run play autism group. I think that's great. What are some of the suggestions of activities to do while we're out at our outings, namely the zoo, aquarium, that we can do together to develop socialization skills between our children? They are all in the 5 to 8 range. Thank you. And this is a great conference. She bribed me. So that's why I asked that question there.
She bribed you?
Yes.
Okay.
This is a great conference. Anybody who wants to get their questions answered has to say great things about this conference.
Okay. Well, let's see. you know, you have to give, you have to structure the social interaction. So let's say you're at the zoo and you want the children to talk about the elephants, for example. You will have a pre-planned, and it doesn't always go as planned, by the way, idea of how you might encourage the interaction. You could say an older child who, let's say, is 8, talk to the younger child about elephants and develop a dialogue in that way. Peer teaching is, and peer relationships that are developed that way are often very rewarding for both sets of children. Turn taking, and if you're going to an outing at the park, for example, pivotal response therapy. I'm Laura Schreibman, and I don't ask me how to spell her name, but and the Kegels is C O E G L E, I think, at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Developed the concept of pivotal response, which is learning to take turns.
Yeah.
And that's very a good way to get kids to interact and to develop social skills. And it can be as simple as rolling a ball back and forth or playing catch. Or doing any of the things that are, you know, a typical developing child might do.
Sure, sure. I've got a really great question, which I'm sure everyone experiences this, and that is, her name is Holly from Clinton, and her question is, since autism is a disorder that affects the whole family, what type of services does the rest of the family need?
Boy, is that a terrific question. And I'm going to start with my family because that's what I can relate to. And I'll talk about my youngest son, Joshua, and my daughter, Jessica, is older than Joshua. And I can remember the day Joshua came in the house just screaming, crying, and he says to me, "I don't understand it, Mother. She gets all the attention, and she's faking. She's just faking."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know the child isn't Jessica wasn't faking, but for him, it was, why is she getting attention and I'm not?
Right.
And that can become a real theme among siblings. And I see a lot of sibling distress around not only any kind of disability that's in a family because they don't understand it. Every child needs his or own level of attention and family interaction. And many times when you are out and about or even in your activities of daily living, everything centers around the child with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard. So a sibling support group is I think, very important, and making sure that the siblings are heard, because it even to this day, I know, and my kids are older, you know, there is just this inherent sibling rivalry that sometimes goes on. The other thing that is very important is to take care of yourself. Make
mm-hmm.
sure that you get enough rest, that you eat well, that you are able to, especially moms, because moms have to work 24/7. And it just goes on every day, all day. And
mm-hmm.
if you don't take care of yourself and give yourself a break, the house of cards will collapse. And you not only have to take care of yourself, you have to take care of your marriage. And and sometimes that means, you know, going to counseling or therapy and finding a therapist who understands the issues that evolve around having a child with special needs.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to, again, if you take care of yourself and your marriage, you'll and have a social network for yourself and your husband and family, then you will survive and survive well. But boy, is it a challenge. And I can speak to that personally because you're always in uncharted waters and life can throw a curveball at you faster than a speeding bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, and the least of which is not just the child, but everything that surrounds the child, the school districts. The insurance companies, and you feel like you're battling on every front. So
right.
Therapies, outlets, maintaining good relationships, and even if that means providing or obtaining, like in California, you can get respite services from the regional center, and making sure that you use those respite services to protect and give you and your husband some time together.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because it seems like the marriage it gets really, really strained a lot, and certainly having respite care is important. Is there any other thing that people out there can do to kind of work through their relationship issues when this is happening?
Well, not to blame anybody, you know. I know there's a lot of research going on in terms of genetics and autism, and it's very easy to point the finger. Well, it's your fault, you know.
Right.
And not to. You know, it is what it is. You have a child with a disability. What are the constructive ways that you can deal with it? How can you structure, every day, having a plan so
mm-hmm.
that you allow time for yourself, allow yourself to go to those exercise classes or go shopping or, you know, because you will lose perspective. And then you will begin to be angry at those around you, and you can't. You will become overwhelmed. It's like the things will pile on the wagon until the wheels of the wagon break. So
wow, there's a lot of people that empathize with that. Really,
so
do.
It is a monumental problem. If you're going to help your child, you have to have a family and a community of support. And it's really hard for single parents. And if you're going through, I can't tell you the number of families that I've encountered that are getting divorced and angry and everybody's
mm-hmm.
fighting, and that certainly doesn't help anybody.
Right, right. Man, this is a great. Later on we should do a call strictly on this because there seems to be a lot of people out there who are all going through this, and maybe they just need a place to vent and talk about it. So yeah, that's a thought for another opportunity for a conference call.
It's absolutely. I can't tell you how important it is.
Yes.
Because you may win the battle but lose the war.
Right.
And you don't wanna do that.
Right. I've got a great question here. Thanks so much for elaborating on that. That's really good information here. And that brings us to our next question, and his name is or maybe her name or his name, Johnny Ramsey from Concordia, Kansas. when inquiring about yoga, does there need to be any special training for the instructor, or would anyone train in yoga do?
Well, there is a special training for yoga teaching or employing yoga principles for children. Now, that being said, I don't know what organization sponsors that. But probably the most important thing is that the person that is providing the yoga class is very child-centered and understands children with disabilities, and also that you have enough support in the yoga class. For example, at Beacon Day School, when we have our yoga classes, it isn't just the yoga instructor and six kids with autism, because you couldn't manage all of that. You have to have the support person. You have to have the instructor, but also, like, it depends on the class, like one support person for two children so that they can help the instructor do the yoga poses and those kinds of things, because a lot of the kids just can't do it by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and there's one other therapy that has, that I should have mentioned and I didn't, and that is pet therapy. Kids
love
pet therapy,
pet therapy
dogs.
Okay.
That is another terrific therapeutic modality, and that's been proven effective even with children in hospitals. Many hospitals allow therapy dogs in hospitals,
sure.
And there are certain criteria for the therapy dogs, that they have to have a certain amount of training and they wear a jacket and they, you know, but that is another great way to get kids to communicate with each other around the therapy dog. And at Beacon Day School, we have a dog in the park day maybe twice a month.
Okay.
So that the kids can get out and be around appropriate therapy dogs.
That's I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm sure some people here may want to look at that as another possibility, on the things they can try.
It's really great, but you just have to make sure the dog is very, very well trained, because these kids will, you know, they may inadvertently hit or bite or do whatever, and the dog cannot react.
Right.
And you have to be, make sure, and there are certain organizations that will provide you, I believe, with a therapy dog, but they may be different in different parts of the country, so I wouldn't know necessarily one umbrella organization for that.
Sure. Looks like we're about halfway through the call now. It's gone by so fast. But we've got, I don't know if you can't see the screen that I'm looking at, but we have over 120 questions that have come in.
Oh, my goodness.
So I know we're not going to get to all of them, but I want to kind of pick off the ones that I think are kind of going on with the thread of the conversation. And one of the ones that I've heard this question before, and I'm sure this is right down your alley here, is Janet from Illinois. How do we manage the compulsive repeating actions?
Well, you have to understand the source of the issue. Repetitive behavior can be a result of increased anxiety or self-stimulatory behavior. So it depends. If, for example, children, if they are not engaged in an activity. Their self-stimulatory, repetitive behaviors, you'll see them increase. So keeping the student and the child engaged in an activity, and I see it in school particularly, is very important. Other things like skin picking I've seen, and other behaviors, self-hitting your head, are all either self-stimulatory or a result of anxiety. And you know, the skin picking doesn't even necessarily hurt them, or the head banging may not even hurt them. And I can give you an example. There was a young man, a boy that I knew that came to Beacon Day School for a while, and he would have a tantrum, and he would bang his head on the floor, and I couldn't decide whether it was behavior or he was having a seizure, but all I knew was that this couldn't go on, because if he didn't have autism, he was going to have a head injury, and it was scaring me. So
sure.
It certainly was a behavior, but he it was a learned behavior, and it took us quite a while to extinguish that behavior. But the repetitiveness can be either self-stimulatory, or it can be anxiety. You have to decide what it is, because you can speak to a behavioral therapist, and I would suggest that you speak to someone who has experience in autism and is a board-certified behavior analyst.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently got that credential, and it's a very important one to have when you're working with children with autism.
Mm-hmm. You spoke of therapy dogs before, and it turns out someone just sent a question in really quick here. Her name is Terry Cooks from Capitol Heights, Maryland, and she asks, where do you acquire a therapy dog?
I think the best way, if you're in Maryland, where is this call coming from in Maryland? What is the location? Is it in Baltimore or outside of Washington?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Well, wherever it is, sometimes you can call your local children's hospital. Like, you might call Johns Hopkins Hospital, and because they may allow therapy dogs in, and then they can give you the name of the organization that provides the therapy dogs, or but I don't know in Maryland an organization that you know, I just wouldn't be aware of it in Maryland that would provide the therapy dogs. But calling hospitals and pediatric units and seeing if they have therapy dogs will be a good lead, because I know at the Children's Hospital here in Orange County, they have therapy dogs. They have a therapy dog program associated with their volunteer program, and that's a good way to find out.
Okay. So check with their local hospital to find out what therapy dogs that they have available and see how they can participate. Okay.
It, like, call Johns Hopkins, and they have to have a volunteer department. All big hospitals do. And then ask for somebody who works, who volunteers in their pediatric unit, and see if they have any knowledge of therapy dogs. And that's,
okay.
the best suggestion.
I have someone that kind of chimed in here, and they kind of made a statement. They said, they acquired a service dog 14 months ago, and he has done amazing work. I would highly recommend a well-trained dog like we have. I agree, it's an amazing therapy, and an even better tool. So looks like people are.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity because the kids can go out with a therapy dog, and therapy dogs can go in restaurants and in the movies and even on airplanes. And and people will, you know, they just love to come up to cute dogs, and with a cute dog and a cute kid is a great combination.
Sure, it is. It is. I have one person who has posted a question twice, actually, and they have a question regarding what do you think of the Montessori ABA for children with autism?
Well, Montessori, Maria Montessori developed really the ultimate multi-sensory approach to learning, and she did that with underprivileged children in Italy. And so I think if you're talking about a multi-sensory approach in conjunction with ABA therapy, is that what the question is?
Yes.
It would depend on how it was implemented by your behavior therapist. And the individual needs of the child. Certainly, I think multisensory can be very beneficial to a child, but you have to be careful that the child doesn't become sensory overloaded. And the reason I say that is that there is work by a researcher named Minchu, who studied neuropsychological issues in children with autism, and stated that it was a complex information processing disorder. So if you overload the child with sensory input, they may not do as well. The ABA therapy has a long history of being an excellent intervention strategy for children. So if you're trying to get the child to be less tactically defensive and you're using an ABA approach, that would be very important and might work very well. The other thing that I want to make sure people understand is ABA therapy is more than discrete trial training. Discrete trial is only one modality of behavioral interventions. So I just want to make sure people understood that.
Okay, very good. I've got this one question that I have not heard of before, and I wanted to ask you about it, and it's from Holly from Clinton again, and what do you think about hippotherapy? Have you heard of that?
Hippo?
Yes.
H-I-P-P-O?
H-I-P-P-O.
I don't even know what it is.
Yeah, I just did a quick Google search, and it seems like it's related to horses in some way.
Oh, well, equine therapy is great. I mean, if you're talking about therapeutic riding, Jessica, my daughter, rode horses for years. As a matter of fact, she was the first one to ride horses, and then, not to be left behind, my entire family rode horses. we don't do that anymore, but I think therapy, horseback riding can be a very good modality for kids and adults with autism. And I know I'm dealing with moms, and most of you have younger children, but the children grow up, and at some point we really need to address issues of adolescents and adults, because we all have to think to the future. And when my daughter Jessica was young, you know, I could only see in the moment, but now she's in her late 20s, and I think of all the things that I went through, and what I should have done and didn't do. So that's a whole nother conversation.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's going crazy here, Dr. Lang. There's like 145 questions.
Oh, my goodness.
And let's see here. I'm just trying to figure out which ones here that we can pick up. I know there were some pre-questions that we got earlier on. Let's see if I can go through some of those here. Let's see here. Well, I think one question here that one parent asked is, are there any books, actually one teacher asked, are there any books that that one should get that teach them about autism, given that many teachers, according to her, don't really know enough about it? Could you recommend a book that, you know, for a teacher?
Well, I just have been appointed associate professor of education at Azusa Pacific University, and one of my challenges is to find or write or do something to find a textbook that would help teachers understand autism and to teach and provide educational care in a more effective manner. And I wish I had an answer to that question, but I don't. Now, that's not to say there aren't good references out there. And one of them is Applied Behavioral Analysis for Teachers, which is an excellent book. And unfortunately, I'm at home and I don't have all these references right in front of me. But that is an excellent reference. If you're looking for curriculum materials, Basics 2 is excellent. You can get that from San Bernardino City Unified School District. And none of these are specifically related to autism for teachers, and it's a sad commentary that our universities are so far behind.
Right.
They are really behind the curve, because there isn't even a course taught in autism and related disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish I had a better answer, but I don't.
Okay. I guess one person here has asked, are there any questions related to Asperger's? And I do have one here from Candace, I believe, in Racine, Wisconsin. And her question was talking about self-STEM behaviors. She says her son is very anxious to accommodate him. I'm sorry, it says, what's the difference between behaviors stimming and tics? Or what is the difference between behaviors stimming and tics? He hums, clicks, spits, flaps his hands, will spin, bang his head, will stretch his jaw or neck, looks at his hand incessantly. Which do we address? Which do we overlook as being needed so that he can regulate himself? Thank you. That's kind of a tough question, too.
Yeah, that's really a huge question. Anxiety causes things like obsessive compulsive disorder, like picking and those kinds of things, are related to anxiety disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So you will, you can, what you really need is somebody like a certified behavior analyst to come in and do a functional analysis to see what is more related to a anxiety disorder versus what is self-stimulatory secondary to just sensory stimulation that the child needs.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really answer you specifically without seeing your child and really understanding what he is doing, because when you see a child with so many behaviors, everything seems to run together, and you're going to have to set a priority. And one of the things that will help is, for example, if it's anxiety related, then you one of the effective strategies is antecedent management, and that's just why is he anxious? What is, mm-hmm. what in his environment is causing him to be so anxious? Are the task demands in school too much? Is it a sensory overload? What is it? So then you can handle the anxiety. The sensory stimulation is a little bit more challenging to handle, but you can channel it into more age-appropriate behaviors, like OTs use them. They're little balls that you can squeeze in your hand. And you have to understand that we all have sensory-seeking behaviors. Smoking is a sensory-seeking behavior. So it's just what is age-appropriate and what's not, and to what degree.
Okay. I wanted to make a comment here. People here are really chipping in here to help each other out. One person posted a website called Autism Service Dogs of America.
Oh, there you go.
And just went to the website here, and, yeah, they specialize in service dogs for people with autism. So let's see here. Looks like it says Lake Oswego, Oregon, I think. So apparently they are able to support people from all across the U.S. I haven't gotten into the details of the website, but for those of you that needed to know that address, again, it was Autism Service Dogs of America. And so those of you that are, you know, want to find out more about service dogs for autism, I'm glad you brought that up. It's amazing. People are just chipping in here as we're talking and asking us, you know, helping each other out. So.
Well, I didn't even know that, and that's so wonderful.
Yes, it is. It is. I've got a question here from Dawn, who's calling from St. Croix, Virgin Islands, and their question is, are DAN doctors useful?
Are DAN doctors useful? Well, I'm sure most of you know, but DAN doctors, and I've been to several DAN conferences, are doctors that are schooled in alternative medical therapies for children with autism. And I will tell you, I think it depends on the DAN doctor. I think mm-hmm. it depends on your child, because I think there are many different types of autism. Autism is not one thing. It's mm-hmm. a spectrum disorder and is, by definition, is extremely complex. One of the challenges in knowing what therapy works is that most of the children that I see or that I know are involved in multiple kinds of therapies. So they may be doing chelation therapy, they may be doing hyperbaric oxygen, they may be doing gluten, casein-free diet, but nobody is really sure which one is really making the child better, if you know what I mean. You just don't know. So I think when you're working with a DAN doctor, take small steps and move slow so that you understand and you make sure that your child is making progress on that particular intervention.
Mm-hmm. Great. You know, I just got another comment regarding the book on teachers, actually, and there's someone who chipped in and said they just bought a book called 10 Things Your Student with Autism Wishes You Knew. So I guess that's taken from the perspective of the teacher. the things they need to know. So for people that are looking for a book, that might be a place where it might be a book you might want to consider, according to Linda from Mount Laurel. She seems that book has been very helpful to her.
Oh, that's true.
Let's see here. Let's see here. I have one question here from a woman from Green Bay, Wisconsin, it seems like. Go Packers. And it says, our son is 17 and has Asperger's syndrome. He has no friends, but he gets along with the kids at school. He wants to be normal, to have a girlfriend and just friends in general. Any suggestions? I guess that's kind of an open-ended question, but I think you kind of get the flavor of what she's trying to ask.
Well, I understand kids with Asperger's syndrome, of course, the children want to be normal. The question is, let's see, I'm going to take a step back because I think it's important for children or adolescents with Asperger's to be to have opportunities to learn to socially interact with children or adolescents that have a similar disability so that they don't feel, so they develop their own support group and then they learn how to ask people out. And a good resource for that is Michelle Garcia Winter's books, and she has a website. Her last name is Winner, W-I-N-N-E-R, and she's a speech and language pathologist and has done a lot on social interactions. But it is more than asking a girl out because these kids don't, suppose the girl said yes, then what would they do? Do they have a plan? Where would they go? You know, so there's a lot of priming and social skills that are required in that kind of social dynamic. And this gets me into the topic of adolescence and moving into adulthood, because the kids, as they grow up, they not only do they want to have friends and dates, they want to have a job. They want to have, quote, a normal existence. And so there's a lot more, it's how do you do a job interview? What kind of jobs are best suited for your young person? And there are jobs out there that these kids can do. And one in my transition program at Beacon, the kids get out into the community, and we go to a marketing company. When the marketing company has one of these machines that does mass mailings, and you have to run the letters or the postcard through, and it puts dear resident or whatever it does on it. Well, one of my students loved that job. Just thought it was the greatest job in the whole world.
Yeah.
Most people thought it was the most boring job in the whole world.
Right.
But he could do that, and you know, he and the owner of the company came up to me and she said, "Oh, I'll pay him $20 an hour just to get him to do that job."
That's great.
So a lot in our society depends on finding the right fit, social skills, adaptive behavior coping strategies, knowing when we need a break, all kinds of things, and that are not necessarily taught in school.
Right.
So finding programs like, and Michelle Garcia Winter has published a great deal, and using her books and finding social skills programs in your community and adaptive behavior programs, adaptive skills programs in your community can really help you a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, let's see here. We have a woman here, Lisa from Lodi. These are one of the earlier questions we received, and her question was, my son is very sensitive to sound and gets overstimulated when there is a lot going on. He seems to cover his ears often and echoes and repeats a lot. What do you suggest as far as having his auditory processing check, and what therapies would be best for him?
The first thing I would do would be to probably go to an audiologist, and there are pediatric audiologists who can really check his hearing. And it isn't his auditory nerve that goes mm-hmm. from the external auditory canal to the temporal lobes of the brain. It is really how the brain processes the sound, and sounds can become very overwhelming. So finding those sounds that are annoying, and sometimes you just have to avoid them. If it's the vacuum cleaner, you don't run the vacuum cleaner when the child's around. If it is fireworks, you don't go to fireworks. Sometimes the children at Beacon Day School can't stand to hear another child upset and will want to remove themselves if a child is screaming or crying. So, and sometimes a child, like I've seen children put their hands over their ears even getting off a school bus because they anticipate the noise from the playground and places like that. So those, again, it gets back to the concept of antecedent management and finding out what noise is particularly sensitive. And it can be everything from volume to the complexity of the sound.
So they really have to be in tune to what their child causes this. I mean, it's sort of, how do you do that? I mean, do you sort of remove sounds and figure out which one it is? Or?
Well, you can do that. Being a good observer, and I know that's easy for me to say, but it's really a complex process. And when you're engaged with your child and you're being a mom, doesn't mean that necessarily you can observe from an objective point of view, because you're engaged and you have to put the child in the car and you're driving home and you're doing all sorts of things and you're multitasking. So, having a behavior specialist come in and just observe the situation from a totally objective point of view can give you an incredible amount of information and useful information, because sometimes you can control the environment to prevent the problem.
Okay. I have a question from someone who's actually, I believe they're from, looks like they're from Texas here. A great question, actually. I don't know if you've have experienced this or maybe have a suggestion for her, but her name is Blake from Victoria, Texas. And what is your opinion on the best approach to get smaller communities in rural areas with smaller school systems to rise to the level of care our children on the children on the spectrum require?
Oh, well, new things are happening. The word is telemedicine. Now,
say that again.
Telemedicine, TELEMEDICINE. And it was started by the Navy, actually, because on these big ships where they have thousands of personnel, they couldn't have, all the different doctors and, they couldn't have a hospital on board. So they the concept of telemedicine was born, and our technology is so sophisticated nowadays that you can work behaviorally with parents and children. And there is an association or an organization called Caring Technologies run by a man named Ron Oberleitner, and he's in Boise, Idaho. And
Carry Technologies.
Carry Technologies. And he has developed a concept of video conferencing with families. And it's one of the things that I really want to do. I think it's really cutting edge because not everybody lives in metropolitan Orange County.
That's right.
So you have to be able to reach families who live in rural parts of the country, and you have to do it in an effective and efficient manner. So Caring Technologies had a grant from the NIH where they were asked to evaluate some equipment so that, for example, a parent could video their child, and then this piece of equipment would have captured the behavior just before, and you could set it for a time like 5 minutes before and 5 minutes after the behavior, so that if there was a behavior analyst like myself on the other end, you could say, oh, well, I see what's happening there. He's really sensitive to the washing machine, you know. And if you cut that out, and you know, not that you didn't do wash, but that you didn't do it, you did your laundry while the children were in school or something. So, very, 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 very important aspect. The issue with telemedicine is the technology is there. There's no question about it. And you could implement it tomorrow. Here's what the issue is: funding. Medi-Cal, or Medi-Cal is not Medicare, but what is Medi-Cal? It's not Medi-Cal. Is just California's name for something else. But Medi-Cal.
Yeah.
And insurance companies don't want to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
School districts don't want to cover it. It's a tragedy.
Yes, it is.
It is an absolute tragedy. And Ron Oberleitner is, he's really sort of the guru, but there are all kinds of companies. And what is the issue is, for example, it isn't just what we're talking about in autism. You can have, for example, in real time, let's say you go to an ophthalmologist and you want somebody, a second opinion for your eye problem, you could have your ophthalmologist in California and an ophthalmologist expert in New York look at your eye or your retina at the same time and get a second opinion. So this is a whole, it's not a new concept, it is a concept that is now able to generalize to the general population, and it's very cost effective and a very positive way to support people and individuals not only with autism but with other issues, and you can't get the insurance companies and districts to fund it.
Yeah, that's really tough. You know, it's going to take time, but I think we're going to get there. I really do.
Well, the more that people know about it, the more that people fight for it, the more the sooner we'll get it, because there are people in rural communities who have no access, none.
Right.
And it is just an unacceptable problem.
Yes. I've got another person here, Denise from Des Moines, Iowa. She says she has a 6-year-old son in first grade with mild PDD NOS. It seems that he uses potty sounds as a way to stim during certain activities at school and can be quite disruptive. How should we approach eliminating or replacing the stim?
Well, you do two things. I'm sure what happens when he does this stem, everybody says, shh, do that, and he's getting a lot of secondary attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I would stop giving him the attention and then try to replace it with a more appropriate behavior that would be acceptable in a kindergarten class.
Sure. Okay. Let's see here. I believe one person mentioned Medicaid.
Yes, Medicaid. Thank you. I don't know why
okay.
I couldn't think
yeah.
of that, but it just
people
didn't
are,
come into
people
my
are
head.
Listening very carefully here. Have you heard of people using earplugs at all?
Sure. Earplugs can be used, but you can't use them, or maybe you can, but all day, every day, because otherwise the children, if you can't use them in school, for example, all the time, because then the children wouldn't be able to hear what was going on effectively. So they can be used, you know, at different times, depending on what the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And if they'll tolerate them, that's a whole other issue.
Sure. Let's see here. We're up to 172 questions now. This is crazy.
Well, maybe we'll have to do this again.
Yes, I think so. There's just so many questions here that keep popping up. Let's see here. So many questions, so little time. Let's see. I'm just going to pick one here at random. Let's see. I think I've asked these before. Here we go. One person, I think it's Sabrina from Camano Island, Washington. What is the best way to help a school and a classroom understand the differences of a high-functioning Asperger's child?
Generally, one of the things that I would, it sounds easy, but it's very complex. People, teachers are human beings, and sometimes they only understand what they want to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So the first issue is to really understand your child yourself and make sure you go to a neuropsychologist or somebody who is knowledgeable about understanding how children process information. Once you've done that, then you can try and ask for an IEP or a student study team and try to explain it or have the person who did the assessment explain it to the IEP team and study team. Now, here is the challenge. The challenge is when a child with high-functioning autism or Asperger's syndrome is in a general education class, it doesn't mean that once a teacher knows that the child has a strength in a certain area and is challenged in another area, that they're necessarily going to change their behavior. Because they've been taught to teach in a certain way. And they don't have support many times within in the school and the school system to modify their teaching strategies for an individual student. They're taught to teach to the masses. To the mainstream. So when you have children that are not exactly fitting into that mold, then they have difficulty, even though they know that a child is a visual learner versus an auditory learner.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And to that note, I have a question that's actually kind of related to that to a certain degree. And that is, I guess a lot of parents go through this. Her name is Julie from Canada. And she asked, what do you do when the staff at the school your child attends are not willing to incorporate necessary techniques and programs, et cetera, that will enable ASD children to cope in their classrooms? I mean, I guess people run into that occasionally.
Oh, I think you run into it more frequently than not.
Yeah.
I don't know what your choices are in Canada. I know in if you're in the United States or in California, which I can address, I would call an IEP, which is an individualized education plan meeting, and say this, it isn't working. The issue that you must have and you must ask the school district to produce is there data based on your child's goals and objectives that the child is actually succeeding? Because, and let me explain to you, on all the IEPs, there is how is the goal and objective measured?
Mm-hmm.
And it can be measured by data collection, like a frequency count. How frequent does the child get up out of his seat? Okay,
right.
not attending to his class. What are his work products? Can he do his math? Can he write a sentence? Does he know his alphabet? And then other. Well, most frequently in special education, they'll mark other, and there is no data.
Mm-hmm.
So everything, if you're asking a school district to modify their curriculum, one of the things you want to know is, and because they're going to say this, well, our curriculum and what's going on is just fine. Well, who said so? And where's the data?
Right.
You have to have the data. And if you want to do something else, like you want a more behaviorally modified classroom, there may be teachers who are more structured and might provide a better milieu for the student. So I would ask to see a variety of classrooms. I would ask for a behavioral specialist to develop a data collection procedure. I would look at work products, but no data, then you have nothing to go on, and you know, if it isn't down there, it doesn't exist, basically.
Right. Okay. Let's see here. We have one other question here, and I think it was, before I get to any other questions, if you could sort of describe to people here who have children on the spectrum, sort of what are the most important takeaways they need to have for therapies and something that they can leave here with to say they can start trying this right away?
In terms of therapies?
Yes.
Okay. One of the most important things that I would look at for children is you want to give them a means of communication. Just because a child can verbally speak does not necessarily mean that they can communicate. So you want to make sure a child has the means of communicating. The second thing with that you have to consider is mental processing speed. Many of the children with autism and developmental disabilities do not process information rapidly. So let me give you an example. If you speak another language, so I'll use Southern California. I don't speak Spanish. I know enough to make myself dangerous. So I go to Mexico and I say, something like Buenos Dias, and order my food in Spanish. And unfortunately, the waiter thinks I speak Spanish. Well, he's rattling off in Spanish. Well, he's lost me.
Right.
And that's what happens to kids. Language and communication happens in milliseconds. and not seconds. If you, and I would challenge you to go to your husband, and when he asks you a question, to wait 5 to 10 seconds to give him a response, and you'll find out how long a period of time that is. So for children who have information processing deficits, that lag time is very significant. So to be very cognizant of that in the child's responses, and make sure that educators and other people that work with the child are aware of those responses.
Mm-hmm.
That lag time.
Right.
Other things to other things to really take away relate to prevention and antecedent management. A lot of behaviors can be managed by looking at the environment and making sure you understand what the child's developmental challenges are with regard to his environment and activities of daily living. And even in math or in school, something that might be very easy for us might be very hard for a child to conceptually to grasp. And so doing a task analysis and making sure that a child has the fundamental concepts down is critical, because that will prevent some of the negative behaviors. Because once you have a challenging behavior and it has been reinforced, it is much harder to extinguish than if you try to prevent it in the first place.
Right, right.
So, and I think if you are, and I want to say something for adolescents and getting out into the community. Getting out into the community is critical, but it's also very important to prime the places where you're going to go. Like, for example, at Beacon Day School, the kids go grocery shopping. So we went to the grocery store and we talked to the manager about the children coming and going shopping, because sometimes you don't know, you can't always prevent something in the environment. You can't prevent another baby that's crying one aisle over. You don't have any control over that, and it might set one of the kids off, and then you need a strategy within the store so that you can maintain the dignity of the child and the safety of the child in that environment.
Sure.
So those are just some taking home thoughts.
Great. I'm sure that's going to be great for a lot of people who want to take something away from what they've heard today. There's close to 2 hours here of information coming at them and a little bit of overload, but we're coming close to the end here. And I'll try to pick out a couple questions here that we can kind of end on. One of the ones I received was from Pam from Baltimore, and her question was, what is your opinion on teaching HFA sign language? I don't know if you've heard of this. Could you sort of...
HFA is I'm not sure.
Okay.
I really would have to explore that and make sure I gave a correct answer.
Okay. Okay, no problem. Out of these 182 questions now, let's pick a number here. Let's try... let's see here. Here's one person that asks, her name is Alice from New York, and her question is, if a parent thinks that her child should receive speech therapy 5 times per week because the communication is extremely important, but the school district doesn't want to increase it, how much should she push for this?
I think it depends. For example, I guess what I would ask, I would pose a different question. I would say, is it group therapy? Is it individual therapy? And then how is it implemented in the classroom? How is that language reinforced in the classroom? Because you could have it 5 days a week for a half an hour and it not be as effective if it was integrated in the classroom every day, all day.
Right.
So I'm really interested in saying, yes, I absolutely want speech therapy, but I want to know how the teacher and the aides in the classroom or the behavioral specialist is following through with that therapy.
Right. I've got another question, believe it or not. It's Amanda from Cambridge, and her question was, what is the best way to help our kids deal with being picked on or bullied in school for being different? I heard this question yesterday, and I know this comes up a lot with a lot of parents.
Oh, it's children are not always nice people.
That's for sure. I remember that when I was a kid.
Yes, right. Yes. And they can be very clicky, very isolating, and a lot depends on the parents and the teacher and how that is all handled within the school and the philosophy of the school, because that will set the tone. You do not want your child picked on under any circumstances. And there are, you know, there are teachers who handle that beautifully, and there are teachers who don't. And there are administrators who handle it beautifully, and there are administrators who don't. So you providing not only a safe physical environment, but a safe emotional environment must be paramount in your assessment of where you send your child to school.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can undo a lot of good work in rapid order if the child is not physically and emotionally safe.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a big problem, and I tell you, it's we had that question 2 days ago, yesterday as well. And thanks a lot for kind of adding to that answer. I have one question here. What are your thoughts on SI therapy?
Sensory integration therapy, I think is what...
Oh,
I think
that's
that,
probably what they meant.
Yes, I think it is. I think sensory integration therapy is very important and a very useful tool in the overall treatment and educational interventions for children with autism, because one of their primary issues is that integration of sensory input and complex information processing, and the body, the mind can't deal with everything, all the input, and so having a interventions and strategies, including sensory, what are they called, a sensory bin in the classroom or next to the child, so the child, if they need to squeeze their hands, they have these little sensory balls and things they can play with that are age-appropriate and can help the child gather and reorganize so that they can continue to function.
Sure. Great. I just want to sort of comment here. I have Lynn from Boston who says, thanks so much for a great conference call. I have 4 pages of notes. So there are people out there writing and just, you know, really getting into this. This is really exciting. I mean, it's, I guess the internet is so great to be able to connect people together. I wanted to go on. There's one question here from Julie from Canada, and her question is kind of an interesting one. Maybe you can shed some light on this one. How do you transfer skills learned in a contained environment, such as a special needs classroom one-on-one with the teacher, into a regular classroom setting and society in general? Kind of a pretty broad question, I guess.
Small steps move slow.
Yes.
You don't take the child who's been in a special needs classroom with a one-on-one instructor, behavior specialist, and then suddenly transplant them the next day into a general ed classroom. You have to take very small steps, maybe have the child spend 5 minutes in the general ed classroom, and build on that to make sure that the child is able to handle all the sensory input and all the information and the rapidity with which information is provided. Because if you move too fast, you may find you get a negative reaction because you move too fast, not because the child can't handle it.
Right. Wow. Well, we are kind of at the end here. We got about less than 2 minutes left. I just want to say, Dr. Lang, thank you so much for the time you spent with us today. I've gotten some great takeaways. I'm sure everyone else did too. And I really would love to have you back to maybe talk about relationships in the family, you know, when people are going through all the issues related to autism and the other members of the family. I think that people really want to hear more about that. Maybe one day we can do that. And I just want to say thank you so much for your time.
I would really like to talk about issues with family and siblings. I also want to talk about transitions from school age and adolescence into adulthood, because that's where we're headed. And we have not, as a educational and scientific community, done sufficient work to help these kids move into a productive, happy adult existence.
Sure.
So
sure.
Those are very important issues.
Fantastic. Dr. Lang, once again, thank you so very much. Those people that are still on the call, I'm going to just have you stay on the line for a little bit, a minute more, or something I want to tell you about. Dr. Lang, thanks once again. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. This has been a great conference call with Dr. Lang. She really discussed some great things about therapies. I was wondering if you could do me a favor, if you can give me your feedback and thoughts, a testimony, if you will, what you liked about the call, what you didn't like about the call. Give us your raving thoughts about it, what you loved about it. There's a little link at the bottom that says, give me your testimonial. I'd love to hear from you. We want to do more of these, so you know, the more feedback you give to us, the better we can meet your needs in the future. And once again, thanks a lot for tuning in the call. There was over 400 of you on the call today. And tomorrow, don't forget to tune in for the call on IEPs. We have a very prominent attorney from Los Angeles, Mark Woodsmall, who is very well known in the community. And he's going to talk about IEPs. He has a son who is also on the spectrum. So he pretty much talked about how he walked through the system and how he does great things, giving the parents the strength and the ideas and thoughts and techniques to really generate great IEPs so that you can get a better scope of where your son and daughter is going to go. A little late in here in the evening, but I want to say once again thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you guys tomorrow. Okay, all right, bye bye.
Hello?